The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of any organization, including One Generation Away.
The freedom of a people to choose its leaders is the root of liberty.
Keep alive this experiment in liberty.
Liberty, in case you've forgotten, is the soul's right to breathe.
Government should be very minimal in protecting liberty.
Peace cannot be purchased at the cost of liberty.
The sturdy ground of liberty.
Liberty once lost is lost forever.
Fight for their liberty and for our security.
Guarantees individual liberty.
This great republic born alone in liberty.
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 Just how much do you want liberty?
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
A production of LibertyNation.com.
Cutting through the double talk, taking on the topics, going after what the politicians really mean, and making it all clear. For your freedom and your liberty. Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
What is the case for Donald Trump? The brilliant author Victor Davis Hanson joins us to lay it all out. Welcome back into Liberty Nation Radio, a production of LibertyNation.com and heard from coast to coast on the Radio America Network. We'll bring Victor Davis Hanson on in a moment to discuss his 30,000-foot view of the Trump presidency and the thinking behind Trump's policies in his new book, The Case for Trump, which shot all the way up to number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. Meanwhile, the Democrat presidential candidates continue to roll out one radical idea after another. Reparations for the descendants of slaves, abolishing private health insurance, abolishing the Electoral College, packing the Supreme Court, lowering the voting age to 16, massive tax increases, a government takeover of the whole economy and the Green New Deal, with free college and free health care for everyone. What will the Democrats think of next? We'll hear the latest on our signature segment, Say What? Plus, in Talkin' Liberty, LibertyNation.com Legal Affairs, editor Scott Cosenza jumps on board to discuss a new bill which would place cameras in the Supreme Court. Well, ever since President Trump arrived on the political stage with shock and awe almost 4 years ago, reactions have been wildly divergent. Everyone seems to either love or hate the 45th president, with few people undecided. But the reactions have been largely personal and emotional and political. What's been missing is an intellectual underpinning for the policies and vision of the Trump presidency. But the man who joins us now has provided exactly that, going where few men dare to tread. Victor Davis Hanson is a classicist, military historian, columnist, and farmer out in California. But he's known mostly for his brilliant writing as a public intellectual who's just written an important book entitled simply The Case for Trump, one of more than 24 books he's authored over the years. Mr. Hanson, welcome to Liberty Nation Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I really appreciate it. Now, with a man as mercurial and instinctual as President Trump, how hard was it to pull all the pieces together and assemble a coherent volume on his political philosophy, especially considering the wild ride that's been the first 2+ years of his presidency?
It's very difficult. I tried to start out with the idea I wasn't going to make Trump a saint or a sinner. I just wanted to analyze to the degree I could his route to victory, which was very improbable, and then the actual achievements once he was in office. But as you state, there were a lot of problems. One is that everything seems to change each week, so what you try to do is analyze in the long term, what is his long term, if everything is as it's going now, what would be likely to happen in the future, or try to be dispassionate so you don't get in this 24-hour roller coaster that his tweet today was great and a tweet yesterday was stupid, but see a pattern there, and so that the book will have some resonance in 2, 3, or 4 years. And then you've got to be very careful, because what people say about Trump is not necessarily accurate. I mentioned in the book, I mean, CNN told us he took out Martin Luther King's bust right away from the Oval Office. We were told that he met in Trump Tower with Russian operatives, that he suborned perjury from Michael Cohen. So, and you got to be very careful when you read accounts like that. And then finally, as a historian, I've never written on a contemporary political figure, much less a president, but I understood, given Trump's controversies and the people are so invested in aborting this presidency, that there would be a lot of passion. But I didn't quite think I'd be called a Nazi and in service to a Hitler-like figure, or people would say that you were sloppy or inaccurate. And then when you see what they say, they don't, you know, they don't quote what you actually wrote, or it would refute those charges, or interviewers will call you for magazine articles and try to ambush you and say, we love the book. Hey, by the way, I'm recording this. And then what they print has nothing to do with the transcript. So there's a level of vituperation and anger at Trump that it's almost as if our noble means of ending his presidency justify any means possible, or the noble end justifies any means possible to accomplish it. And so that was kind of new for me, to have this every day wake up and some guy's calling you a Nazi, or some person says you're a hack, or you want a job in the White House, or something like that. Attack the messenger rather than the message.
Well, one enduring question about Donald Trump and his presidency is whether there's a method to his madness. Now, having covered this and done all the investigative journalism that you did to come up with this book, The Case for Trump, do you find that he's more a guy who strictly goes on instinct and he's just kind of freelancing it out there? Or is he more calculated than people think? Does he have a grand plan?
I think he does, but he's not as if he's playing fourth dimensional chess, as some of his supporters allege, and nor is he a complete amateur just ad hocing it all the way through. I think he has a general vision that China was not destined for world hegemony, that even though they have three times the population of ours, one American produces three times the goods and services as one Chinese citizen, and that's pretty impressive on our part. So there was a confidence that he could deal in a different way with Chinese mercantilism. It wasn't fated. He said he really had an instinct that you cannot have a sovereign country with an open border and 15 or so million people living here illegal and coming in at that rate. He had an idea that you just don't write off half the country between the two coasts and say, well, they're all on opiates or all deindustrialized, or in a globalized world, they're not competitive. You can't do that and have a country. And then I think he also had an idea that Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, that we have not been translating tactical victories into long-term strategic advantage, at least in a cost-benefit analysis, and that we need to be much more careful and build up our defenses, but be more retaliatory than preemptive. And that was sort of a message that not only was new, but it was also imprinted on the traditional conservative message of low taxes, deregulation, strong defense, good judges, strict constructionist judges. But it was also geared in addition to the key swing states. And he understood in a way that no one else apparently did, and Hillary Clinton especially, that the election was going to be decided in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida, and it was going to be decided by a few thousand votes, that these Democratic constituencies could either be flipped or more voters could come into the voting process that had stayed home from McCain and Romney. And that was that took a degree of not just cunning and instinct, but imagination that I think he never got credit for.
Our guest is Victor Davis Hanson, the brilliant columnist and author of the new book, The Case for Trump. Now, Mr. Hanson, many reasons have been given for Trump's shocking victory in 2016. Outrage in the heartland, the areas you just described, most often cited as the reason for it. But he also had perhaps the perfect opponent in Hillary Clinton. Do you believe Trump would have won no matter who he faced, or could a more appealing Democrat have beaten him, do you think?
Well, I mean, she did win the popular vote, mostly because of the 3 million people in California that gave her a huge majority. But I think she was particularly suited. Her weaknesses were particularly suited for Trump, because on every angle that she tried to tag him with scandal, his indiscretions with women, then his her husband came up. Trump, nobody's alleged that Trump did anything wrong as far as infidelity or worse inside the White House. They did with her husband. She tried to go after the Trump Foundation. The Clinton Foundation scandals make the Trump Foundation amateurish in comparison. She tried to say that Trump might have been colluding with the Russians. There was no evidence of that. But there is evidence that Bill Clinton got $500,000 speaking in Moscow at a time when millions were being poured into the Clinton Foundation from Russian industrialists and entrepreneurs who at the same time were looking to get a contract for uranium control in North America, about which Hillary Clinton had a considerable say as Secretary of State and influence. So what I'm getting at is each time that she went after him, he just said, well, look at you. And that sort of neutralized his vulnerabilities in a way that maybe another Democratic candidate, had they nominated someone with less exposure, wouldn't have been as successful. She was also a poor candidate. I mean, she didn't speak well. She did things that she didn't have to do, alienate people with this deplorables, irredeemables. She went down in Arizona and Georgia thinking that it was a sure thing and she was going to get a mandate, tried to flip states that were not going to be flipped, while she let Trump as a proverbial fox into her hen house in the Midwest, and he took those Midwest states.
Now, ever since Trump announced for president, the Republican Party seems unsure of what to make of him, to say the least. But the veto on his national emergency notwithstanding, has he now managed to take control of the Republican Party? Do you expect Bill Weld or someone else will wind up challenging him in a 2020 primary?
I don't think so, and if they did, it would be very short-lived. We forget two things about Donald Trump. That is, for all the Never Trump vituperation, the Weekly Standard, my colleagues at the National Review and elsewhere, George Will, all of that, 89% to 90% of Republicans voted for Donald Trump. About the same number as had voted for McCain and Romney. I'm not saying that he got a smaller level. He did get a smaller percentage of independents than some of them had, but more or less the Republicans stayed with him, and more or less his message, even though I suggested it was new and there was wrinkles to it, the foundation was Republican conservatism, cultural, traditionalism, low taxes, strong defense, GDP growth, more energy exploration. And so that was pretty, what was different was that he was not a part of the bicoastal establishment. He had first president to have neither political or military experience, and he was not shy about suggesting to them that that was an advantage. And they were corrupt. They were part of the swamp, the administrative state, the deep state, as he said. And they didn't forgive him for that. So the establishment, we haven't quite seen that, that an establishment of one party would turn on its own presidential candidate and then indeed continue to do that while he was president. That's new.
Victor Davis Hanson. And that's just part of our interview with him about his book, The Case for Trump. We will play you the second part on next week's show. Quick break, and then we're back to discuss the breakdown of Brexit.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Exhausted by all the fake news? On LibertyNation.com's YouTube channel, facts and fresh, bold analysis are what you get without the leftist spin. Subscribe today to the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel because
truth,
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 truth
is
making
a
comeback.
Believe that all men are entitled to blessings of liberty.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Brexit, the referendum in England that kicked the populist movement into high gear and foreshadowed the election of Donald Trump in 2016. But ever since Brexit was voted in, It's become a political football with several efforts by the encrusted political establishment to weaken it, water it down, or get rid of it altogether. And in the midst of this, Prime Minister Theresa May has repeatedly failed to negotiate a deal that can pass muster with the British Parliament and made enemies among both the pro- and anti-Brexit forces. Here to help us sort it all out is LibertyNation.com managing editor Mark Angelides, who joins us not from his home in England, but right here in studio. Welcome to the colonies, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
Pleasure.
Good to be here.
Just a few days to go now before the deadline of March 29th for Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. You know it down to the hour, don't
it's 11
you?
p.m. That's UK time, not US time.
Indeed, but Brexit has proven to be a moving target. Why has it been so difficult to come up with a deal acceptable to the British Parliament?
That is the million-dollar question, Tim. And the wise voices suggest that it's because there was never meant to be a deal that would thoroughly encapsulate actual Brexit. And that's the point behind it. If there were Brexit, then this whole European project for the UK and pretty much for the European Union would be over. So if they could actually achieve a deal that extricates Britain from all of the institutions of the European Union, then the whole project's over because Britain's one of the main contributors. So what they've been trying to do is not to get a Brexit deal that takes Britain out of the union, the political union, but one that keeps it in through the back door. And this is why they're having difficulties, because nobody really wants, well, the people who voted for Brexit don't really want to be kept in, as we call it, brino Brexit in name only.
Right.
Much similar to your American rhinos.
Sure.
But because nobody who actually wants Brexit is really willing to accept Brexit in name only, then the Prime Minister, Theresa May, and the majority of parliamentarians who are all for Remain, they're all trying to keep Britain in while saying it's coming out. And that's the problem. So they're trying to create a deal that looks like Britain's left without actually leaving.
Mm-hmm. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said she will fight until the final hour of March 29th to avoid a no-deal Brexit. Now, how big a role is Merkel likely playing in all this, and how would a withdrawal from the EU with no deal affect the EU, and how would it affect Britain?
All right, three questions. Let's start with the first one. Angela Merkel is the de facto leader of the European Union.
Right.
Partly because she's the chancellor of the biggest economy in there.
Even with her announced retirement coming up in, what, 2021?
Oh, you watch. Her announced retirement will be little more than a slide sideways to the head of the European Commission, would be my guess.
Sure.
Or at least a very high-level position within the European Union. There's no loss of power on her part, despite... I mean, this is where the European Union, where old politicians go to die and wreak havoc.
Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.
Mark Angelides, managing editor for LibertyNation.com. Coming up next, our signature segment, Say What?
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Exhausted by all the fake news? On LibertyNation.com's YouTube channel, facts and fresh, bold analysis are what you get without the leftist spin. Subscribe today to the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel because...
Truth.
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 Is.
Making.
A. Comeback.
This is Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
Say what? Say what? Say what? One more time.
Say What? The signature segment of Liberty Nation Radio. It's when we roll out some of the most wacky, astonishing, and damnable things uttered by politicians and the chattering class. Radical ideas have become mainstream in the Democratic Party, where 16 candidates have now thrown their hats into the presidential ring. The latest to enter the fray is New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who then went on a CNN town hall and spouted a dizzying array of leftist cliches, followed by a new way to describe illegal immigrants.
I believe that immigration has always been a strength of this country. Our country was largely founded by immigrants and largely built by immigrants. Our diversity has always been our strength. We have a Statue of Liberty standing in New York Harbor with that beacon of light and hope saying, send us your tired and your hungry. Send us your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And that is not what we're seeing from this president today. What he has done on the border is inhumane and intolerable. He is separating families, children from parents. Immigration is not a security issue. It is an economic and a humanitarian and a family issue. There is no such thing as an illegal human.
So, by my count, she used five cliches before going to the illegal human thing. Immigration, always a strength of our country. Our country was largely founded by immigrants. Our diversity has always been our strength. Statue of Liberty, huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And Trump is separating families at the border. As far as original thought goes, Senator Gillibrand would get a grade of F. And if she lands even one delegate in the upcoming primaries, consider it a surprise. But she's got a whole lot of competition when it comes to political correctness among these left-wing Democratic presidential hopefuls. Pocahontas Elizabeth Warren dropped a couple of beauties this week, like when she was asked about the hot new issue on the left, reparations for the descendants of slaves.
America was founded on principles of liberty and freedom and on the backs of slave labor. This is a stain on America, and we're not going to fix that. We're not going to change that until we address it head on. So I believe it's time to start the national, full-blown conversation about reparations.
Well, try to imagine the Democratic debates where every candidate will try to outbid the other on reparations. And none of them will oppose what, until these last few months, was considered a genuinely radical idea. But Pocahontas wasn't done. She also proposed a solution to the Democrats losing two presidential elections this century despite winning the popular vote, starting with yet another left-wing cliche.
Every vote matters. And the way we can make that happen... is that we can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College and everybody.
Right. And then all the candidates can ignore those flyover folks who had the audacity to vote for Trump and campaign only in big metropolitan areas, which is exactly what the framers of the Constitution sought to avoid. Then there was Spartacus, Senator Cory Booker, who tried to avoid calling himself an out-and-out capitalist by using a really clever turn of phrase that was mocked by leftist Chris Matthews on MSNBC.
What's wrong with being for capitalism?
I am for capitalism. I'm tired of companies engaging in socialism, where they outsource,
okay, all right, that's a,
where they
that
outsource
is, okay,
their costs. They outsource their costs.
I know, that's a good rhetorical flourish.
I gotta say, that's a new one. I am a capitalist, but I'm tired of companies engaging in socialism by outsourcing or something like that. Then there was the buffoonery of Joe Biden, who's supposedly set to enter the presidential race any time now. Here's a guy whose malaprops have all but defined his political career. You can't go into a 7-Eleven unless you've got a slight Indian accent. Asking a guy in a wheelchair to stand up, said, God rest the soul of a woman who's still alive. So it was strikingly appropriate that the former vice president would commit yet another verbal gaffe this week about his very entrance into the presidential race. He has conspicuously not been an announced candidate, but he slipped and said he is, while jumping on the far-left progressive bandwagon, of course.
I have the most progressive record of anybody running for the United States. If anybody who would run. I didn't mean...
What a group.
The Democratic debates, the first of which is less than 3 months away, will undoubtedly be an exercise in progressive one-upsmanship. Who's the most radical and who hates Trump the most? After that massacre in two New Zealand mosques recently that killed 50 people and injured scores of others, the fact that the perpetrator mentioned Trump once in his 70-page manifesto was enough for the left to pin the blame for a horror show on the other side of the world on, of course, the 45th president.
The president did not take any opportunity today to distance himself from a killer, a terrorist, a person who took 49 lives of people who were worshiping. He didn't take any opportunity to say that he wouldn't be inspiring people like that.
Donald Trump's derogatory comments about Muslims and his refusal to condemn white supremacy have undermined America's moral authority when events like what happened in New Zealand take place.
Other tough questions, whether the president is emboldening right-wing extremism with his immigration rhetoric.
This is a president who has given plenty of rhetorical ammunition, I think, to terrorists like this.
Among the attackers there, Joy Reid of MSNBC, Jim Acosta of CNN, of course, and Ned Price of NBC News. But Mick Mulvaney, Trump's chief of staff, condemned the condemners, saying the mention of Trump by the madman who pulled off the New Zealand massacre as a symbol of white identity, that was not the end of what he said about Trump.
The next sentence was, what about for his policies and as a leader? And he said, dear God, no. I don't think it's fair to cast this person as a supporter of Donald Trump any more than it is to look at his sort of his echo terrorist passages in that manifesto and align him with Nancy Pelosi or Ms. Ocasio-Cortez. This was a disturbed individual, an evil person. And to sit to try and tie him to an American politician of either party probably ignores some of the deeper difficulties that this sort of activity exposes.
So that was a good answer, but then Mulvaney made a classic mistake in responding to the left's description of Trump.
The president is not a white supremacist. I'm not sure how many times we have to say that.
Now, Mr. Mulvaney should know by now that you don't respond to a scurrilous charge by repeating the charge. If I call you a pedophile, you don't respond by saying, I'm not a pedophile. But Mulvaney's defensive statement that Trump is not a white supremacist was, of course, the headline. The president has been more active than ever on Twitter, especially last weekend when he went on a Twitter binge. And one of those tweets was based on a statement by former independent counsel Ken Starr about one of Trump's least favorite persons in life and death, John McCain, who sent an envoy to the UK to pick up the infamous, scurrilous, and discredited Trump dossier that then became the basis for the almost two-year-long special counsel Robert Mueller.
I really am disappointed that now Senator McCain, who is a great man, I knew him, I admire him, I think he is an American, was an American hero, but I'm very sorry that he got implicated in this in terms of spreading this really nasty stuff around.
So Trump took the opportunity to tweet out a nasty gram about McCain, and McCain's daughter Meghan sent out her own insulting tweet and then went ballistic as co-host of The View.
He spends his weekend obsessing over great men because he knows it and I know it and all of you know it. He will never be a great man.
No. Yeah. No.
And so my father was his kryptonite in life. Yeah. He's his kryptonite in death.
Right. So let's just forget that it was Meghan McCain's father who first unleashed the fury of the Trump dossier and brought us down a road that has balkanized the nation, even as it now looks like it will reach a dead end, that Mueller report. Oh, and let's just forget that it was Senator McCain's single vote which killed the repeal of Obamacare hours after he promised to vote in favor. But he's a real hero. Now, how biased is the establishment media? Well, it's one thing for conservatives to call out the obvious hatred for Trump in the media, but quite another when the same point is made by a guy who's a member of the legacy media and has been for decades, longtime host of ABC's Nightline and now a contributor on CBS News, Ted Koppel.
I'm terribly concerned that when you talk about the New York Times these days, when you talk about the Washington Post these days, we're not talking about the New York Times of 50 years ago. We are not talking about the Washington Post of 50 years ago. We're talking about organizations that I believe have, in fact, decided as organizations that Donald J. Trump is bad for the United States. But the notion that most of us look upon Donald Trump as being an absolute fiasco, he's not mistaken in that perception, and he's not mistaken when so many of the liberal media, for example, describe themselves as belonging to the resistance.
It is likely only because Koppel is 79 years old and in semi-retirement that he has the guts to call out the transparent bias of his compatriots in the establishment media. But rest assured, he will be scorned for it. Finally, we come to the death of late-night comedy, which has degraded to bitter political daggers singularly aimed at Donald Trump on most of these shows, and a remnant of the old days when people watched late-night TV to actually escape the world and laugh a little. Jay Leno went on The View and said what viewers are undoubtedly thinking.
You don't like the idea that the late-night comics are so one-sided. Is that true?
No, it's not I don't like the idea. It's just the fact that all the jokes are... It's kind of the same joke. You're all kind of doing a different version of the same joke. To me, I always like to humiliate and degrade both sides equally. See, it was different. I did it when Clinton was horny and Bush was dumb, and it was what we call a simpler time.
Not anymore. And that goes for Saturday Night Live, another target of Trump's recent tweets. It was once side-splittingly funny must-see TV, but now... just another vessel for leftists in the TV industry to attack Trump. But I will say, there's one exception in all this. Jimmy Fallon, who continues to be hilarious while making fun of Trump the way a comic should make fun of him, with a light touch, seeking laughs instead of applause. After all, there's a treasured trove of comic material there, even to the people who are Trump supporters. We'll break away for a moment, then come back with Talkin' Liberty and cameras in the Supreme Court.
Liberty Nation with Tim Donner.
And now we have reached the concluding segment of Liberty Nation Radio, which we entitle Talkin' Liberty. It's when we invite our regular contributor and constitutional lawyer and LibertyNation.com legal affairs editor Scott Cosenza into the studio to talk liberty. Hello, Scott.
For everyone's favorite portion of the program. Hello,
yes,
Tim.
Yes, it is your favorite portion of the program. I will reveal my choice for favorite segment
in the
interest
of
discretion.
Yes.
A lot of Supreme Court stuff today. First of all, a bill in the legislature, otherwise known as Congress, specifically the Judiciary Committee, would require the Supreme Court to allow cameras in the courtroom. This is a significant issue.
It's really surprising that they would press on this, Tim, having gone through the Kavanaugh hearings,
right,
I think.
Now, right.
when Chuck Grassley was chairman of the committee in previous years, he sponsored this bill. He's now no longer on the committee, but he's a co-sponsor. It's now being brought by Dick Durbin, who is on that committee, along with a couple of the Democrat presidential aspirants who are also on that committee, Amy Klobuchar and... I don't know if it's
Cory Booker. Spartacus,
right.
Yeah, Spartacus.
Or one of the
Spartacus
other
ones.
Oh, no, it's Blumenthal. Vietnam vet. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, yeah. What do they call him? Da Nang Dick.
Oh, right.
Da Nang Dick. That's Trump's nickname for the stolen valor.
And I think this is interesting on a number of angles. First of all, having seen the protests' disruption of the televised hearings for Kavanaugh's confirmation, I can't understand why somebody would think it would be a good idea to require televising the Supreme Court. We know that these politicians play to the cameras on C-SPAN all the time, and we can only assume, and I mean, history just tells us every single time that this happens, people will play to the cameras. So the justices then will have to play to the cameras, the advocates will play to the cameras, and the audience members will play to the cameras. I think it seems like a disaster. And then there's another angle, which I think is also interesting, which is how does the Congress deciding what can and cannot go on in the United States Supreme Court? Aren't they a co-equal branch of government? The U.S. Constitution, Tim, delineates what the rules there are for the Supreme Court.
More specifically, they're a separate branch of government over which the Congress does not have control other than to consider and ultimately confirm candidates to federal courts, including
that's
the Supreme Court.
That's part of the
checks
and balances, but
right.
They are co-equal. And
right.
Just like the Supreme Court can't say to the Congress how they run their house. They could rule on laws that they pass, but not the internal operations of the Congress. Doesn't seem to me that this would pass constitutional muster. Would be curious to see if it were passed. And Chief Justice Roberts, who leads that branch of government, decided he didn't want those cameras in. That would put a constitutional crisis up, depending on how the executive function then would weigh in.
I can't imagine any of those Supreme Court justices would want their work being televised, essentially.
There's another aspect of that, actually, which is they can now go down to the Piggly Wiggly and buy a carton of eggs, most of them, without being harassed as either baby killers or the opposite or whatever.
Right.
Whatever giant contentious
issues. Those days
issues,
would end. That would end.
They would end in a nanosecond. And while these people are compensated relatively handsomely compared to the median income, they're not compensated to a level where they can buy giant estates removed from civilization and have fleets of, phalanx of guards. I mean, they want to live, they live relatively normal lives, these people, and I'm sure they want to continue to do so.
Scott, I get the sense that somewhere Lance Ito is either smiling or frowning. Yeah. The famous judge from the O.J. case who played to the cameras to a degree that we never saw before and haven't seen since. Okay, still on the Supreme Court, mandatory detention of criminal aliens, according to the court, is constitutional.
What happened is Trump, with an aggressive anti-illegal immigrant push, what they've done is there have been people who were here in the country illegally. They were arrested for a criminal charge and then let go. And then there was no follow-up by immigration authorities because there was lax or no enforcement of that. In an effort to clean that up, now the authorities are going back and saying, boom, we're nabbing you because you have this arrest for X, Y, and Z. In the case of Moni Priap, it was a prior marijuana possession arrest. They got him into trouble. And they just basically arrest you and throw you into the clink without sort of the right to any initial hearing, right? And that's what this case is about. The Supreme Court ruled these types of aliens do come into that that classification. Mm-hmm. And what this means, and this is a win for the administration's attempt to increase enforcement of our immigration laws, and this is a loss for the people who are on the other side of that, who want lax enforcement. Now, whether sort of liberty has won or lost, my analysis is going to have to wait for another day when I have a little bit more time to digest the opinion. But I can tell you that the dissent, which was from the left bank of the court, focused more on a conservative sort of values proposition in the dissent. In other words, they were saying language that typically comes from the right, that the plain meaning of the statute was not honored with this type of enforcement.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
This program, Liberty Nation Radio and LibertyNation.com's own podcasts, The Uprising, hosted by Scott, and The Rabbit Hole, Politics and Prose, hosted by our managing editor, Mark Angelides, available to you on demand, online at LibertyNation.com, and from fine podcast providers everywhere. So that is it for this week, but we'll be back at you next week, same time, same station. Till then, this is Tim Donner saying, stand up for liberty. And we'll see you next time on Liberty Nation Radio.